All right, here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
One. The Linux Link Tech Show is proudly sponsored by Open Country, providers of OCM, award-winning systems management software for the Linux Enterprise, and exclusive sponsors of the Webmin Project.
Who's the best show here?
Tech Show! Tech Show! Tech Show! Yeah!
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Yeah.
And it's just the turbo in the background there.
Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show.
That's it.
Hopefully Link is not too loud now.
Yeah. Why can't I turn that off? Oh.
Tis I.
Alright, there you are. Sorry. I wanted to turn that off and it wouldn't. Damn it. Okay, welcome to the Linux Link Tech Show, episode 174, correct?
Ooh.
Yep, 174.
A whole lot of episodes.
174. Wonderful guest tonight. Really excited for this guest. Pat, introduce our wonderful guest.
We've got the great Jeremy Allison from the Samba Project, and now from Google.
Hi.
Welcome to the show, Jeremy. Great talking to you. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So what's new and exciting in Jeremy's life?
Oh, okay. Well, I changed jobs recently, which was, I guess you could call it exciting. Not exactly fun. Changing jobs is always a bit of a pain, but, yeah, so I left Novell over the Microsoft Novell agreement, as you may have noticed. What do you want to do? I work best if you actually ask questions rather than just sitting here talking to myself.
Okay. You were
so
formally,
what do you want to know now?
You were formally... let's get the most obvious questions out of the way first.
Okay.
You were formally with Novell. You've been with the Samba Project for a while. Novell paid you to work
Well, since it's... I mean, I was the first person to send Trigger Patch. Volker was number two, so... basically, I mean... as long as Samba's been going, really.
So, what made you leave Novell?
Okay, well, I tried to like the Microsoft Novell agreement. I really did. I heard about it a little bit before everyone else did, being internal, and I knew it was going to be controversial and interesting. And you know, parts of it I thought, wow, this is really great. You know, Microsoft is beginning to take things seriously, and oh look, they've chosen Novell, which, you know, as a Novell employee at the time was actually a rather flattering experience, I thought, because, I mean, I thought we were doing really well with Novell Linux Desktop. I was being pulled into lots of new customers. I was mainly working on the technology that basically allows that desktop to integrate really well into Windows, you know, to do things like disconnected operation, so you can, you know, you can take a laptop on a Windows network running Linux, take it home, you know, boot it up again and log on using your cache credentials, and everything just works. And there was Samba technology that was working behind all that. So I thought we were winning. But unfortunately, there was one aspect of it that just, the more I looked at it, the less I began to like it. And I really did try and like it, so I must try and explain to people I really did try and give it my best shot to, wow, this is wonderful. And the problem was, of course, it's the patent covenant agreement, which, not being a lawyer, just to me, it looks like a fancy way of saying, oh, we've just licensed Microsoft patent. Which, when you look at the GPL very carefully, in GPL Section 7, that's a no-no. That's a GPL violation. And that was too much. I mean, I'm a big fan of the GPL. I've pushed a lot of software to be GPL'd in my lifetime. I've encouraged other people to use the GPL for things. And, you know, in the end, I just couldn't sit down and accept somebody violating what appeared to be... Are they violating the actual contract? Are they, well, it's not a contract. Are they violating the actual license? Difficult to say. They're definitely violating the intent, which is to have a level playing field so that everybody using GPL software gets exactly the same rights as everybody else. In terms of Novell, Novell considered themselves more privileged than others. It's like Animal Farm. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. And Novell was trying to put themselves into that position, and that was what really did it. I couldn't sit down and take that, unfortunately. So I don't want to go into what I did internally, other than I think try and cause a significant amount of fuss. But eventually, I realised that nothing was going to get done about it, and that really they weren't in a position to do anything about it once they'd signed something. So yes, unfortunately, I had to leave. Which was a shame, because I was kind of enjoying myself.
Well, you know, I want to, you know, just step up and say I applaud you for sticking to your principles, because not a lot of people would do that.
Well, thanks. I mean, you know, the funny thing is people are sort of like, I'm reading all the Slashdot comments and you know, the DNet comments on it. I mean, the really funny thing is that people are saying, oh my god, how much of a hardship can it be? You've gone to Google, you know. It's like, you know, I mean, what did they expect? They want to see me standing beside 101, you know, with a bottle of cider in a brown paper bag with a begging bowl. I mean, for heaven's sake, you know. Yes, I arranged something else. No, Mrs. Allison didn't raise any stupid kids. No.
We'll call for food.
Yeah. So
it would make a good picture, though.
So yes, I did arrange something else. That's because I'm not stupid. You know, the people are sort of... Basically, I think some people were really upset because they sort of said, oh, yes, he's standing up for his principles. Oh, wait a minute, he's gone somewhere else. He should be suffering. But for some people, I think standing up for your principles has to be synonymous with suffering. If you're not suffering, then you're not standing up for your principles. So, but well, thanks for that. I mean, I'm probably angrier about it than I'll let show. But that's because I know I have given Novell a bit of a kicking, you know. But I like most of the people I work with there. You know, I'm not. I've never ever left the company on bad terms, and I guess this is the closest I've ever done to doing that. And I feel really uncomfortable about, you know, flagging Novell off, because I like them. There's a bunch of really great people there. They're really nice people. I just can't stomach what they've done, you know. And it's not the people I knew that did that, because a lot of the people there were like, "Oh my God, what have we done?" You know, it's the corporate entity. So I'm trying to, you know, get a clear differentiation between Novell, the corporate entity that's doing something that I consider unconscionable, and you know, the Novell, the people there who are really nice, and, you know, they're still a bunch of my mates. You know?
Well, there was a recent editorial or comment, blog posting that came out, and I'd have to pull it off of LX, or I forget exactly what it was. But anyway, they said that... You're saying differentiating between the employees, the people that work at Novell, and the decisions that Novell makes as a company. And the gist of this blog posting was that the decisions Novell has made as a company are going to reflect badly not only on, you know, the people that work there, but also in OpenSUSE, because it's guilty by association. And do you think it's going to be tough, you know, for community members to differentiate?
It's going to be tough for those guys. Yes, it is. And that's really sad. You know, I mean, they've got a great product. I thought it was technically probably the best desktop that's out there. I mean, at least in terms of the bit I worked on, I was really happy with the Windows integration. You know, so yeah, it's going to be hard. It's going to be very hard. But yeah, I mean, the thing to remember is that OpenSUSE isn't. Yes, it's a Novell product, but they don't get any money from that. It's SLES and SLED that are the, you know, the actual royalty-bearing products. So essentially, they're the ones that I think are GPL violations, and I don't think OpenSUSE is. But yeah, it does, you know, unfortunately, it reflects badly on people, and you kind of get tainted by association. I don't think it's anywhere near as bad as you know, what happened with people who chose to stay at SCO, because there were, you know, that was just... That was completely beyond the pale. But it's still, you know, it's not a great situation to be in, and I didn't want to be in that situation. Essentially, because I'm a bit of a loudmouth, you know, I'll say what I think, and I knew I couldn't continue working there and stand up and give talks, and essentially say nothing about it or say I supported it. So, you know, the only thing I could do was to leave. Really.
Now, it's interesting because after a lot of the interviews with you had come out and posted, I found a day later there was an article on SDA Asia, the magazine for enterprise IT, IT management, and IT business. And
where do you find these?
This was on Hellexer. The article title is Windows versus Open Source in 2007. And my general impression of the article was that they were kind of favoring, you know, the Microsoft side, saying, wow, Microsoft has finally embraced Linux and is, you know, trying to work with the Linux community. And then here's this guy named Jeremy Allison who's saying,
he's a zealot.
This is no good.
He's an insane person, yeah.
This is no good. There is nothing but evil is going to come out of it. They really painted you as the maniacal leader of the, you know, diehard evangelist when... You know, every interview I read of you was completely opposite to that, and it was impressive how they put their slant on it, you know?
Wow, when do I get my own jugs of Kool-Aid to hand out? the committee's coming. That's kind of funny. Well, I guess you could say that. You know, I mean, that I'm sure... Forbes and the business people are like, well, why don't these open source people just shut up and let us use their code for nothing? it's like, I did try and point out that, you know, it's like essentially Novell screwing over its suppliers and saying, oh, look, we found a clever way to avoid paying you, and expecting the suppliers to say, oh, well, you got us there. You know, It's a fair cop. Yes, that was very clever of you. I guess we'll just have to not be paid. Well, you know, we get paid in code, and we get paid in code on the same terms as we give it, and those terms don't include patent indemnification. And that's a really big, important thing. I don't think people realize how dangerous and damaging software patents are. The funny thing is that the company that suffered the most from software patents is Microsoft. I remember working with a lawyer at HP who said to me, he said, one of the most sensible things ever, he said, the people who have to worry about patents are those with deep pockets, because they're the ones who are going to get sued. But yeah, it really is, software patents essentially are a blight on the creation of software. You know, they just, they make it extremely difficult for open source projects to continue, because you never know when you're going to, essentially, you're going to blunder onto some crazy software patent. So, you know, and the funniest thing I find about software patents is that the goal of the patent system is to encourage innovation by allowing you to look at the clever things that other people have done and license them, and, you know. And I don't know any software engineer who looks at patents. I mean, everybody, you know, every software engineer I know is told not to look at patents because of the triple damages thing. So everybody's told, just stay away from patents. So how is that promoting innovation? I mean, that I don't know. The system there is kind of broken. Oh, and I must make an explicit point here. This is J.R. Allison's opinions and not those of my employers, etc., etc. These are definitely my own personal opinions, but I would also probably go so far as to say they were definitely the opinions of the Samba Project as well.
Yeah, it sounded like
not
it.
Opinions of my employer, or any of my employees, in fact.
With the whole patent thing in perspective here, is that the main or the only issue you had with the agreement? Was it the patent thing?
Yes. Were you in? Absolutely.
So you were fine with everything else?
The rest of it's fine. Yeah, yeah. The rest of it's fine. Yeah. Yeah, the rest of it was great. Really, it was the patent thing. I mean, I was kind of amused by that, oh, we're going to work on interoperability and help. And in fact, you know, Novelli was working very, very hard on interoperability, because I know, because I was part of it. It's just that they were doing it with no help from Microsoft. And, you know, for anyone who thinks that this will actually help interoperability, think about the European Union case, where Microsoft have paid out close to several billion dollars to avoid any interoperability information falling into the hands of any open source projects. So, you know, the people who are thinking, oh, it's going to be great for interoperability, it's like, hang on a minute, if Microsoft were willing to pay, I think the last cost is probably about $2 or $3 billion to Sun and Novell and to the EU and whatever, if they're willing to pay that amount to buy people out so that they wouldn't have to give out any interoperability information, what makes people think that they're just going to give that info to Novell? Oh, for use in open source projects, which is what they're claiming. I mean, that's just crazy. This is not going to help. And, you know, in terms of interoperability, you know, I mean, the main obstacle to interoperability is proper documentation of how the protocols work on the wire, and things like, you know, how their Microsoft document formats work. They are the barriers to interoperability, so it always amuses me to see sort of Microsoft standing up saying, oh yes, our customers have told us interoperability is very important, we have to work on it. It's like, well, maybe you could stop actually preventing it as a first start, as a first step. You know, that might help. That might actually be, you know, just a little positive step along the way. Did anyone see that article that came out about the Office XML format that came out recently? Did you guys see that?
How
Which
recent?
One? That it was accepted as the standard?
Oh, it was a couple of weeks ago. I think it was on Slashdot. And basically, this was somebody going through the... It was really funny. I felt a very strong sense of familiarity. Somebody was going through the Office XML documentation, the spec, the one that has, quotes, just been standardized. And they were going through it and saying, hang on a minute, let's see how easy it is to implement. And they found, you know, parts of the standard that says things like, oh, here's a tag that if it's set, you have to enable Word 95 compatibility. And the note is, if this is set, you have to try and render in the way that Word 95 would have done. And that's it. This is a legacy thing that, you know, modern things shouldn't set. But if it's set, you should do your best to implement it. And it's like, that's it. There's no information on, well, how did Word do this? What did Word 95 do rendering that was different from, you know, the rest of the standard? Just nothing. And it's like, I mean, it reminded me of looking at the SIFS spec, which is the protocol that Samba implements. And these areas like, you have to return a level-dependent error code. And you're like, well, what does that mean? Well, I guess I'd better just probe Windows and find out. You know, so the article, I can't remember who did it, but the comment on that was somebody said, this is not a standard, this is a DNA dump. was kind of funny, because it's that's exactly the way that SIFS is documented, or not.
Well, here's an interesting question then about that. Maybe it's not so interesting. Anyway, from what I've read about the standard is that if you are going to implement the standard, you have to implement the full standard, not leave anything else, and not change anything. And in light of those requirements, how would you be able to implement the standard with regards to rendering it the way Word 95
Word 95
is not documented.
Yeah, it's definitely a no-win situation. I mean, so this is one of the things where you really can't you can't license it. You know, the safest thing to do, you know, with deals with Microsoft is not to do them. Because there's always something in the small print.
Well, since you worked inside of Novell, and you are a very popular and prolific contributor, and your Project Samba transcends a lot of different operating systems and the capabilities of interacting with different operating systems and is used in a lot of projects, my question for you is, we've heard from Novell regarding this patent agreement was that there were significant roadblocks, and customers were hesitant about adopting Novell's products, specifically Linux products, because of the possibility of being sued for patent infringement. And they say that this deal provides the customers with insurance. Now, do you see that a lot? Is the issue of patent liability a stumbling block or a roadblock for businesses and corporations adopting Linux?
Well, so, I mean, I'm not... All I can say is, I never heard about that being a problem until they came out and said it was a problem. Now, you know, I'm just an engineer who basically fixes stuff and writes code. So, you know, would I have heard about Novell losing deals because of people being worried about patents? Probably not. So, you know, that may very well be true as far as they're concerned. You know, that, oh, we were losing deals because we didn't have, you know, people worried about patents. Well, that's, you know... My response to that is basically, it doesn't seem to be bothering Red Hat much. You know, Red Hat seems to be able to get significant numbers of customers without having to do that kind of a deal. And so, you know, whining that you can't get the customers that you want, you know, I'm sorry, that does not cut it. It's like, well, yes, it may be true. That's something that I never saw, personally. I mean, I work with a lot of customers, getting stuff to work. You know, nobody ever complained to me, oh, if you just had patent indemnification, we could roll it out everywhere. But then again, no one's going to say that kind of thing to me, because they're mainly talking to me about, Samba sucks, why don't you fix it? This is broken, you know. So that's, you know, that's at a different level, really, within the company. But like I say, it doesn't seem to be bothering Red Hat. And, you know, Red Hat seem to be able to quite happily get lots and lots of new customers. And, you know, Ubuntu and a lot of the other distros seem to be reasonably, well, especially Ubuntu seems to be incredibly popular without anyone worrying about, you know, patent infringement issues or, you know, so, and to be honest, I don't know of any, you know, patents that Linux infringes. But of course, it's in Microsoft's interest not to actually reveal if there are any. The thing is, this fear of patents works much better than the actual reality. Because if you actually have to stand up and say, well, these are the patents that we claim, then those patents can be examined, and, you know, I'm not saying they can all be worked around, but a significant number of them could probably be very trivially worked around, because most patents are, well, let's just say, not very well written. You know, and yes, theoretically, there may be some blocker patents, but those blocker patents are almost certainly, well, I don't know, of course, but many blocker patents are on absolutely trivial stuff that is pretty easy to knock down. So, you know, the threat of patents is much scarier than the actual reality. Plus, if you actually come out and say, well, these are the patents that infringe, then you end up suing your own customers, which is not a winning strategy long term, I don't think.
Yeah, there was a, speaking of patents and the deal, an article on Linux Insider today by Dana Gardner had talked about the Microsoft Novell and unintended consequences from that, and Microsoft, their agreement with Novell kind of put the bug in people's ears that, you know, if you're going to run Linux, you're going to need some kind of indemnification. And now that Microsoft has made a deal with Novell, why won't Microsoft go out and start making deals with actual businesses, corporations, you know, Fortune 500 companies, instead of going through Novell. I mean, why not just have them offer an indemnification license?
Do you think
that's possible?
I don't know. I mean, that's very much dependent on the terms of the license, really, because the problem is people signing patent licenses with Microsoft themselves are essentially violating the GPL, because at that point they, if they're end users and they're not redistributing, that's fine, but anyone who redistributes can't sign a license like that, because what that means then is that they are in a privileged position and they can't redistribute the software and give the same rights to everybody else. And this is the big difference between, you know, because I've seen a lot of people say, well, it's, you know, it's just like indemnification. Why, you know, what's the difference between this and indemnification? But indemnification is really like insurance, whereas this is more like protection money. You know, you're basically, somebody's threatening you and you're paying them to go away, and you're paying them directly. It's not like you're paying into an insurance fund that will cover you in case you have an accident. This is essentially somebody threatening to break your leg, which I think was aptly demonstrated by Mr. Ballmer on stage. Man, he should go for, you know, I know they're finishing The Sopranos, but he would make a great Tony Soprano replacement. He really would. You know, he could be good in that house. I can just see him eating the, you know, the pasta and...
So what you're saying basically then sounds like if Microsoft were to offer an indemnification license like that, that would violate the GPL because
they're very careful not to do things like that, I think, because I mean, who would sign it and what would the terms be, and you know, it's kind of weird. Normally, you offer indemnification or whatever. You offer licenses for your own products. Essentially, this is offering licenses for someone else's code, and that's just. Can you think of a precedent, a similar precedent anywhere else? I kind of can't think of anything.
Actually, I can't either. But I was just, you know, just wondering, you know, why go through the middleman when you could just say, hey, you know, there could be some violating technology in here. Why don't we sell you a license to use our property?
Because the reason for going through a middleman, or at least getting a patsy, is essentially now, because I mean, this is just my impression, what they paid for wasn't really, you know, the patent licensing. I mean, that wasn't what the money was for. What the money was for, so that they could stand up and say, look, Linux infringes our patent. And it must be true because Novell felt they had to license. That's what they were paying for. I mean, that's what they bought, basically. You know, and like I say, they couldn't even wait until the end of the first press conference to stand up and start saying that. I watched that thing live. I was in England at the time, and I was kind of watching it, and I was just amazed that they would do that right in the middle of the press conference. You know, you would think that they would at least have the decency to wait until the press conference was over and do another one or do something different. But, you know, they were making threats right in the middle of the very first conference, you know. Oh, if you're not using Novell Linux, SUSE Linux, then, you know, you have an undisclosed liability on your balance sheet and all this kind of stuff, you know. I mean, it's not far from the nice restaurant shame if it burns down stuff, you know. So that's really what the deal was for, I think. I mean, that's my interpretation of it. You know, I mean, obviously, Novell and the people who did the deal have a very different view. And, you know, a lot of the people that I work with at Novell also, you know, say, no, this is very different. And, I respect them and their views on that, but I just have to disagree.
So do you think that in the near future somebody is going to eventually pull that patent trigger and set this whole war off?
No, I don't think so. I really don't. Because nobody really wants to do that, because essentially at that point you're suing your own customers. You know, because Microsoft, I think, realized that every single Microsoft customer is also a Linux customer. There's no such thing as a Linux-only shop. There's no such thing as a Windows-only shop. So they have to find some way of dealing with it. And, you know, they are trying to find some ways to deal with it. This isn't the way. I mean, I've had dinner with various Microsoft people and even some execs, and I've kind of joked with them that, yeah, the only time you guys will get Linux is after you've had two bad quarters. You know, then you'll start to, you know, then maybe you'll start to sort of... Because what I would really like Microsoft to do, I know I've been ragging on them a lot, and but to be honest, I rag on them a lot because they don't play by the same rules as everybody else. So if Microsoft were to come and say, you know, we would like to do a Linux distro, or we would like to sell Exchange Server on Linux or SQL Server on Linux, you know, I mean, I would probably stand up on stage with them and say, this is the best thing in the world, wonderful, you know? What I want them to do with Linux is to stop being so damn scared of it and to start trying to make money with it. Because once they stop seeing it as this terrible threat and they just see it as another way to make money, they're going to be much happier. That's my opinion on it.
Well, since you have a lot of dealings with people at Microsoft, do you see the attitude slowly changing?
I think what we're seeing, and I have, you know, no proof for this. Again, this is just my opinions. I think what we're seeing is the external effects of an internal war. Because I think that there are people in Microsoft who say, no, Windows is what we have. We'll use Windows. We'll force it down their throats. We'll make people use it. It's always worked in the past. This is the way we should keep doing it. And then you've got new people there who are basically saying, look, the world is changing. We have to deal with it. Linux is a part of it. Let's start trying to work out how to work with this. And I think my guess would be that the deal with Novell was an attempt... Maybe it was an attempt by the second lot to try and deal with Linux, but it really got sabotaged by the first lot. So, you know, I mean, a long time ago, back in the early 90s, I actually worked up at Microsoft. I don't know how many people know this, but I never worked for Microsoft, but I was working for a company that was trying to sell some stuff to Microsoft. So I went up there and I actually worked with a lot of their folks. And it's a very interesting place. It's like, the best way to describe it is it's a series of warring tribes held together by the great Khan, you know, Gates, sort of. It's this incredible, I mean, maybe it's very, this is way over 10 years ago now, so maybe it's completely changed. But at the time, it was, essentially, each group hated each other. They hated each other much more than they hated anyone else. And it's a very competitive place. I think, like I say, I think what we're seeing is the external effects of an internal war.
And as time goes on, hopefully we'll see the tides change.
I hope so. I really do. Because, I mean, you know, look, Oracle has completely, happily started dealing with Linux, even to the point that they're trying to get into the Linux distro business. You know, and Oracle by no means is a free software company. They have this incredibly expensive database, and, you know, it's proprietary and will always remain so, you know. But they understand that Linux is a way to make money, and so does IBM, and so does HP. You know, it's just another way to make money. It's another way to create products that people want to use. And, you know, when Microsoft finally get that and adopt it and start, you know, stop fighting it and start trying to make money on it, like I say, is I think when things are going to get a lot, well, I won't exactly say peaceful. This industry's never peaceful, but a lot calmer. Maybe I won't have to change jobs.
Yeah.
Quite so often, anyway. Yeah. Not that I'm complaining about where I ended up. So.
Google seems to be hiring everybody these days.
It's a fun place to work.
So you're actually there now? I mean, not
yeah.
now, but you're working at Google now. You started your job.
I have indeed. Yep.
And now, are you in California?
Yes.
And so you work.
Yeah, I'm in Mountain View. Well, I live down in San Jose, which is so I commute up to Mountain View. So I am currently drinking from the fire hose, as they say, and Man, it's hard to hard to keep all that stuff down.
Now, did you live in San Jose? Did you move there to work at Google, or have you been living there for a while?
No, I've been there. I've been in San Jose for about 15 years or so.
Oh, okay.
I originally moved out with son. Moved out from, I was actually living in Barnsley in England. It's no joke, living in Barnsley, as they say. And then I moved out to work for Sun, who are also in Mountain View. So it's funny, I keep coming back to Shoreline Boulevard, which is kind of where Google is. I've worked for like 3 or 4 different companies. I worked for Cygnus Roth Shoreline. I've just worked for a lot of places that were actually headquartered here.
So are you doing Samba work at Google, or are you doing other work?
Yeah, I'm doing Samba work, and I'm also working with Google to work out how it fits into their, basically into their internal and external infrastructure. So I don't want to say very much about that. It's a bit like Fight Club. You know, one of the first rules about Google is you don't talk about Google. And the second rule is you don't talk about Google. So
what you're saying is you want to talk about Google. Yeah, okay. That's great. So Samba, I have to admit, I've always had a kind of a prejudice against Samba.
That's because it sucks. It's always broken.
No, not that. It's not that. It's that, to me, you always hear Samba as being, the great integrator between a Windows network and a Linux network. And I've always, my impression was, well, I don't run Windows, so I want nothing to do with a Windows network. But yet, maybe that's the wrong attitude to take, because I hear that it's really one of the more robust and easiest to use network operating or file systems out there.
Well, once it's set up, yes. People do have some difficulty setting it up. The other thing you got to remember about Samba is it's embedded in virtually everything. If you go to your local Fry's or whatever, and you buy one of those sort of disk drive in a box off the shelf, almost certainly it's a little NAS box or something. Almost certainly it's running some version of Linux and Samba internally. That's kind of true. In the old days, it really wasn't something that Unix-only networks would use. But that's actually beginning to change. And the reason for that is essentially NFS. NFS really isn't a great solution, I don't think, for file sharing. You can say, oh my god, you're talking about using a Windows protocol instead. The way I see it is, essentially, every company has a mixture of Windows, Mac, and Linux, right, on the desktop. Now, Windows only speaks this. You'd be crazy to try and put NFS clients on Windows because, Microsoft don't release enough information to make them work right, so they just don't work great. And the Mac now has realized pretty much what desktop Linux has realized is that essentially, out there on the desktop, it's a Windows world. So what you need to do is you need to speak the same protocol that Windows does to the desktop. So NFS and NFS v4 and all the rest of it might be great as a back-end server-to-server thing, but in terms of what are you going to be running down to the desktop, it's going to be SIFS. So one of the things that Steve French, IBM, and I have been working on for a while is something we call the Unix extensions for SIFS. And these are basically a series of modifications to the actual protocol that will allow Linux workstations to mount SIFS resources. Now, right now, the implementer of the Unix extensions, HP implements them, Samba implements them, Linux implements them. I'm actually talking with the Apple folks, the Apple client folks, to get the SIFS extensions integrated inside macOS. But the goal is to make it a fully supported Unix-to-Unix protocol as well as a Windows-to-Unix and Unix-to-Windows protocol. So what that means essentially is, you would mount a Samba share as a, let's say, your home directory. And you can do that right now, and things like remote devices, FIFOs, you get the complete proper POSIX path name support. All of those things work using the Unix extensions. We recently added complete POSIX locking. So, you know how everybody says NFS locking sucks, it doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. Well, the locking in the Unix SIS extensions, it basically is just a remoting of the actual Unix locking protocol itself. So it actually does work. Steve has been running various POSIX lock conformance tests on a Samba-mounted drive, and he passes them. So, you know, the goal is to fit into a Windows-dominated world and essentially say, okay, you guys, you win. The protocol to the desktop is going to be SIS, but Samba's going to create a variant of it that's designed for use with Unix and Mac systems. And we can do some interesting things at that point. We can encrypt traffic. We can do OpLocks. We can reacquire OpLocks. This is, we're kind of getting into the protocol details here. But essentially, we can do a lot of interesting things. Because one of the things I did learn at Novell is the power of being able to control both the client and the server. If you can control both the client and the server protocols, you can do a lot of interesting things that you can't do if you just control the server or you just control the client, because you're then always beholden to someone else's code. But if you control both, you can make things work really well. You can basically do magic with that. Which is, you know, I mean, if you look back and you look at NetWare, you've got to admit that NetWare was a pretty damn good remote file sharing protocol. I mean, it was fast. One of the reasons for that is Novell controlled both the client and server. Now, you know, they lost that. I think one of the reasons that they lost that battle to Microsoft is that they didn't open up their protocol. Whereas Microsoft, at least in the early days when they were the underdog trying to get into that market, they opened their protocol up. They documented it.
And then they stopped documenting it.
Well, yeah, this is what happens once you get, you know, a monopoly leverage. So, yeah, that's what the whole EU case has been about.
So then with the Unix file permissions in being integrated into Samba, how are they going to then interoperate with Windows file permissions too? Would there be a translation of Windows file permissions to Unix file permissions if you mounted a Windows
Steve,
file share?
Steve has to cope with Windows. So when he's talking to Samba,
you guys just get cut off or something?
We're still here.
It sounded like he just got cut off.
Yep.
That's what it sounds like, yeah.
Is Link still there?
Link is still here.
I didn't hear him drop off, though.
It just, like, cut off completely.
Dun, dun. Well, we've lost another guest today.
Wow.
You know what it is? It's that one, you got to ask that one last question about Samba. You got to push that, and off he goes.
I pushed the envelope.
Another in our continuing series of losing guests.
Now, I wonder if he's still talking or if he knows that he dropped off. Or if he can hear us.
Was he on the IRC chat?
I don't think he's on the IRC chat.
Bummer.
I was getting really into what he was saying, too, man. I have more questions to ask.
What? Can you give him a buzz back?
He called us.
Oh. I guess we have to wait for him to decide that he is not talking to us anymore then.
That's
anyway, did you guys just get my message about this Flourish conference?
Yeah.
In Chicago? I just got this email. I'll plug it right now. Basically what it is, let me hit this email real quick. They've been feverishly working to put together, this is the LUG at the University of Chicago, I guess. Been feverishly looking to put together a conference in the Chicagoland area. For the first time, they want to do something about, floss. And they're setting up a nice little conference on, where the heck is it? April 6th and 7th. So they wanted to know if we would, if there's any way we could help out, at least to plug the conference, and, you know, sure, we'll do that for any Linux and open source kind of thing.
Hello?
Hey, it sounds like you got cut off.
The IRC chat,
don't know what happened now. I was just talking and then nothing.
Yeah, no.
So, I got cut off or something.
Yeah. Yeah, you just disappeared. You were going, you were just about to say, oh, what were we, the question asked was, what was the question I asked? Pat, what was the question I asked?
You were asking about,
Oh, translation of file permissions between.
Yeah, file permissions. So I was basically explaining that the client has to do the mapping. And so Steve's client does a less good mapping when he's talking to Windows because there's nothing you can do about that.
Okay. So now that you have the proliferation of Samba, the SMB and SIFS protocol, what's your impression of the Fuse protocols that are coming out using a file system and user space in a kernel like SSHFS and a few?
Oh, Fuse is great. I mean, I really like Fuse. Fuse makes rapid prototyping of lots of weird stuff possible. I love Fuse. Fuse is really great. So yeah, I'm very happy about that. I mean, Fuse is probably the best network protocol workbench that there is, or the file system protocol workbench that there is. So I'm hoping we'll see a lot of really innovative things come out of people messing with Fuse. So, you know, it solves a different problem to the one that we solve, but yeah, I mean, it's really handy for essentially making all sorts of things that shouldn't look like file systems look like file systems.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we have something similar in Samba. We have a VFS layer. People have plugged the antivirus scanners, and somebody made a SQL database appear as a file system and a bunch of other things. But it's nowhere near as easy to use as Fuse is. So, I'm kind of jazzed about Fuse. I think it's another one of those things where just doing something like that and having it open and freely available spurs people to try all sorts of weird and crazy stuff. I mean, and who knows, the next really, really big file sharing protocol might be sort of being tested out in some student's lab somewhere. It's just a way for people to try out lots of different ideas. So I'm kind of happy about Fuse.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. I have some ideas of some things that we can do with it, but I need to spend more time. And right now, time is kind of in short supply. I've got the SIFS conference coming up. No, not for SIFS. Oh God, what is it? Connectathon. So I got to sit down with Steve, and we have to get the open semantics fixed. Then I'm off to FOSDEM in Brussels. So, yeah, I'm hoping to get some time to do some fun stuff later on this year.
Now, when you say Steve, who is Steve again?
Oh, sorry, Steve French from IBM.
Okay.
He's one of the Linux kernel guys who does the... If you're using Linux and you look and you see a module called SIFSFS loaded, that's Steve. Although I've done some fixes to it now, so I finally got my copyright in the Linux kernel. Hurrah!
I have a question. Maybe you can answer this. Whatever happened with POSIX access control lists in
POSIX ACLs?
Yeah, whatever happened to those? I mean, two, three years ago, they were like...
They're there and everybody uses them. They became ubiquitous, at least in Linux, anyway.
But there were so many really great things that you can do in that, but I don't really hear much about it anymore.
How much system administration do you do? Because, I mean, a lot of people are quite happily using them in terms of administration. Because the nice thing, I like POSIX ACLs. I'm a big fan of POSIX ACLs. I did the POSIX ACL code in Samba. And the reason I like them is because they are simple enough for sysadmins to understand and work with. And they're not sort of, crazily overly complicated. The problem with Windows ACLs that NFS v4 has adopted is that they are beyond the limits of human complexity. beyond the limits of human comprehension. Well, not beyond the limits of human complexity, but certainly in terms of sitting down and using something, they are unusably difficult. So, yeah, I mean, every single distro ships with them turned on by default. So, I mean, it depends how much system administration you're doing these days. The one thing I think that we need to work on very hard is our name service interface. And that is essentially user and password database. And I'm going to say something, very controversial here. Windows is way ahead of us in that area. I hate to say it, but it's true. And I'll tell you why. And this is something I've discovered in working with customers. Basically, Windows has designed to scale up in a distributed environment to having, you know, hundreds of thousands of users, different users, and hundreds of thousands of groups. Now, it isn't that Unix can't do that, because Unix has had hundreds of thousands of users and groups for years, way beyond Windows does. The thing that Windows has that Unix hasn't sorted out yet is Windows has a way of actually separating and delegating those users into the domains and actually allowing you to manipulate them sensibly. So if you look at any Windows tool for manipulating users and groups, right, the one thing you will never see, or at least not in any well-designed tool, you will not see a scrolling list of users and groups, right? Because if you've got 300, 500,000 users and groups, just populating that list will take you 5 to 10 minutes. So you have a search box. I don't know if you noticed, all Windows tools these days have moved to a search box. You want to set an ACL with a particular user, you have to search for them. Now, if you look at the underlying interfaces in Unix, there are no search APIs, standard search APIs, for looking up users and groups. The only standard APIs we have are the POSIX ones, which basically are the equivalent of the old list boxes where you have to list everybody.
Okay.
I'm still on?
Yeah, no, you're still on.
I'm kind of nervous about being dropped off again. But
now, I guess my question then with the POSIX ACLs is, you say that they're really used in a lot of system administration. And I guess I'm kind of looking at it and saying, how come it's not integrated into, like, Nautilus or KDE?
Oh, it's just been added. Yeah, it's just been added.
Well, it must be really, really, really new.
Sorry?
Is it... How new is that? Because it's not on my system.
The latest GNOME CVS or subversion or whatever has that in there. Now, unfortunately, and this, I really should log a bug on this. They've implemented it as a drop down list. This might work on the small box in the developer's, you know, mother's basement or whatever, but it's not going to work in the real world. So they've got to fix that. That's just broken. That's to do with, you know, like I said, that's the large scale.
Right now,
the standard snapshots in Nautilus, you know, you click a right click on a file, it says I want to add an ACL, and then it expects to be able to show you a scrolling list of every single user. Problem is, of course, that's what they have to do in terms of POSIX, but that's simply not going to work. You know, imagine that you're in an organization with 100,000 usernames. Or larger, which some of them are. You know, that's just not... Or you've got a certain number of usernames in your local area, and then you've got, you know, you distributed. You've got some all around the world. Just contacting those remote servers to get the list of users from those remote servers, you know, might take longer than, you know... It just takes too long. The network might be down. It's not a scalable way of doing things.
Well, you know, speaking of that, I mean, one of the things that Novell had said that they were really working on was providing, you know, a kind of a management system for large environments, like you're saying. Aside from Novell's eDirectory services and, I guess, rolling your own with Open LDAP, I mean, what really is out there to manage such a large environment?
Well, Active Directory, that's what people use, unfortunately. That does actually work. Mind you, so does eDirectory. Open LDAP can be made to work in that environment. The problem is, it isn't so much the tools don't scale, it's at least that the POSIX interfaces that are designed they're too old. They're 1980s interfaces.
Uh-huh.
In some cases, 70s. It needs to be updated. So I think there's progress on that. I think Ulrich Drepper is looking at it and a bunch of other folks. You know, and I'm hoping to get my oar into that at some stage. but we need to update that. We really seriously need to update it. That is one of the missing pieces.
Now, you mentioned Active Directory, and at this point with Samba, I mean, how well is the integration with Active Directory?
Oh, it's really, really good. I mean, you know, we are a first-class sort of member server taking over Active Directory and actually running as an Active Directory domain controller. That's a different kettle of fish. And that's basically what the Samba 4 research work is ongoing to do.
So it would be Samba 4, then Samba can take over as the primary...
The goal for Samba 4 is for it to be an Active Directory domain controller.
Right.
My comment on that is I don't know what the code will look like when we do that, but I know that when we can do that, that will be called Samba 4.
Well, that should be right around the corner now that Microsoft and Novell are working together for interoperability.
Ah, yeah, right, yeah. Actually, it is, yeah. Let's just say Novell has been working on some products for a long time, and you know, I hope to see the light of day, but they've been worked on well before any agreements about interoperability. Let's just say I can't talk about exactly what they are, but
now see, rumor has it that the day after you left, the Microsoft guy in charge of the documentation for SIFS and SMB was about to drop off a manual on your desk to explain everything, and he couldn't find you, so...
Yeah. I'm sure that was the case. Yeah. They would have told me everything. All I would have had to do was to sign this little non-disclosure agreement and... And sign a license sign the Microsoft Communication Protocol license, which I don't know whether you know, but we explicitly call out on the Samba.org website saying, if you've ever signed that, don't ever work on Samba. We don't want your code.
So, of course, you know, you guys are fighting an uphill battle with Microsoft with regards to interoperability support. What about other companies, operating system companies, Sun, Apple, how forthcoming are they with support to the Samba project?
So I mean, you know, Apple employ Samba team members. Sun never really has. I mean, I like Sun, don't get me wrong. I used to work there. They've never been big fans that much of Samba. HP and IBM have done a lot more in terms of promoting Samba and providing support. You know, it's a strange sort of thing. It's not your normal open source project. It just requires a little bit of weirdness on behalf of the people who work on it, I guess. You know, do I look funny to you? Yeah, it requires, you have to have a certain kind of mindset to enjoy some of the things that we do, and it's not that a lot of people looking at open source projects tend to pick ones that are, you know, more obviously fun. You know, so for instance, just give you an example, I was up until after midnight last night, working again on our path name handling against Windows and you know, but basically putting in error codes for corner cases, because of course none of the error codes are documented, and yet Windows applications depend on those error codes being correct. So we actually have a random tester that blasts a set of file operations at a Windows box and blasts the same set of file operations at a Samba box and logs an error if we ever differ in any of our error codes. So it's that level of you know, paranoia in terms of getting the interoperability right. But you have to do that. You know, and that's not fixing error code returns isn't something that thrills a lot of people. I don't know why. I find it absolutely fascinating, but maybe I'm weird. So it's although I mean, you know, the Summer of Code helped a lot. The Google Summer of Code helped a great deal in getting some high quality people interested in working on some problems there. And we're going to participate in that again. If it's run again, I actually don't know. I probably need to find out about that. I would imagine so, but that's not a promise or anything. So, yeah, what we really need is... People sometimes think, oh, if we could just fund you guys, that'd be great. But to be honest, money has never really been the problem. It's finding the right kind of people who are interested in doing the kind of work that we need to get done. So, and the problem is there's just not that many SIFT engineers in the world. I mean, if anyone was actually looking for a career path, I would really recommend it, because I tell you something, you never get recruiters stop calling you up, because there's always somebody saying, I desperately need SIFT engineers, you know, and there's maybe like 50 of us, and and the recruiters keep fighting over them all. So it's a very good career choice if anyone's thinking of an area to specialize in.
Well, you know, I have a question about that. If somebody were to be interested in specializing in that area, I mean, what is available to them aside from working on the Samba project or maybe working for Microsoft or something? I mean, like, what are these type of positions are these recruiters trying to fill?
Well, usually they're startup companies. I mean, at least here in the Valley, they're startup companies doing something interesting with storage. And the thing is, as soon as you do anything with storage, you have to have Windows clients. As soon as you have Windows clients, you have to use SIFT. So, you know, that's basically how the recruiter, you know, how the job requirements go. And at that point, you need a SIFT engineer. And there just ain't that many of us. So, you know, probably if you want to really make some money, Not that I'm saying, you know, this is a guaranteed way to success, but hey, start working on, if you just want to get a great regular job that people will pay you stuff, you know, pay you to do stuff, start working on Samba and somebody will employ you. Almost guaranteed.
So now, a lot of these companies then implementing Samba as a solution, or are they going at their own and rolling their own, you know?
A lot of them are actually embedding Samba. But they need someone who actually understands how it works, because there are a lot of people who have Samba above their own proprietary kernels and you know, specific features. So, you know, but they need someone who understands Samba and how it works and how to make it work with Windows clients in order to make progress. So it's like a gateway.
So these companies then, are they good stewards? I mean, are they contributing back the code or any changes that they make?
Well, I mean, everybody we know of complies with the GPL. We don't know everybody, of course. You know, so it's very possible there are some people out there who are violating the GPL. But hey, if we find out about it, we always follow up on everything. But yeah, I mean, mostly they take just what it is that we give them. Sometimes, you know, sometimes they do some original work. Oh, that reminds me, I have a patch I need to chase up from one of those guys. To do with splice support in the Linux kernel. But yeah, I mean, so a lot of the time, they will publish their code, but just to their customers. So, but it's rare that they do, the big infrastructure changes have to be done really by the core team, because we're the ones who understand how the code works. So clustered Samba, for instance, that's been done by Tridge and the core team.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, I'm sure there are companies out there already doing clustered Samba, but they don't do it essentially in the right way, which is by making core code changes. Because it's hard to do that. You need to know how everything works.
So if somebody's interested in, you know, trying to break in to working with Samba, I mean, what kind of background or educational background should they have and experience? What would you say?
C programming, interested in network protocols, interested in network performance, interested in file systems. You know, there's a lot of ways in. There's a lot of avenues to get into the code. There's lots of, you know, there's working on front-end GUI support, there's working on clustering stuff, there's working on directory back-end stuff. I mean, it's a little microcosm of you know, an operating system. My joke to Tridge is at one point we'll just end up renaming SMBD to ntoskrnl.exe and have done with it. Yeah, I mean, you can do printing. There's a very large amount of code working with printing. You can do RPC. There's auto code generation work that needs doing. Like I say, it's a microcosm of an entire OS. So, and it does have some nice bite-sized chunks. It's not quite as sexy as the Linux kernel in terms of doing OS work. But there's a lot more people doing that, so, you know, pick something interesting and do Samba instead.
That's cool. That's cool. Now, to kind of drop back a bit about patents, we do have a question that was sent in by one of our listeners who would like your opinion on something. And this is his exact question. He said,
okay.
So would it be safe to say that your view of software patents is that there is only one way to write a Hello World program, and why should that be blocked from everyone else?
I'm not... one way to write Hello World program. No, there's a million ways to write Hello World program. The problem with patents is that they are sort of a block on the concept of Hello World. You know, if it was just somebody... people confuse the three areas of property. There's trade secret, copyright, and patent. And so someone, you know, writing a Hello World program has copyright on their Hello World program. You know, and theoretically you can't play, you know, you can't plagiarize that. You could independently reinvent it, but if you prove you independently reinvent it, that's not an issue. But the problem with patents is you can independently reinvent your Hello World program, but if someone has a patent on the whole idea of saying Hello World in a computer program as a machine, then every single Hello World program will violate it. Doesn't matter how you write it.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, you know, the problem with patents is that they're just awful. They're bad. You know, I mean, I would be hard pushed to see to actually put my finger on a software patent that I actually considered valid. Maybe the RSA patent. Maybe you could push me on that one. That's possible.
Well, you know, here's a question. This is probably maybe a little loaded there. But to your knowledge, does Microsoft have any patents on the ideas behind any of the Samba and SIFS, SMB and SIFS protocols or any of the technology
Not to my knowledge. I mean, they hint about it a lot, and they like to try and talk about it. But essentially, if that really is true, what they have to do is to go out and say, you know, is to take action, essentially.
All right.
So, you know, you can keep hinting all you like, oh, yes, I have deep, dark, secret stuff that you're violating. Well, prove it.
True enough. Now,
you know, they don't want to prove it because either A, it's not true, or B, the deep, dark secrets that they're hinting on really aren't very innovative or novel at all, and if they were examined, they would probably get overturned. That's the other issue.
Uh-huh. So with the whole patent issue and everything, we have the GPL version 3 coming up, and
right.
And, I mean, which I obviously take that you are pro GPL version 3.
Very much, very very much.
So a lot of controversy seems to be around the TiVoization clause in there, the DRM issue.
Yeah, and I don't understand why. I don't understand why actually. I think that's a completely reasonable and logical clause to add. Essentially what it's saying is that, you know, free software developers, GPL advocates, believe that DRM is bad, you know, and if you want to write, if you want to do DRM code, write your own code. Don't use ours, essentially. And I think that's a perfectly valid, you know, it's not even a restriction on a field of use. You can write DRM code with GPL v3, it's just that you can't use it to restrict the user's freedom. So you can write a secure system using DRM, using GPL v3, and so long as, let's say you were selling a medical record system written using GPL v3 code, and it had to use DRM to protect stuff, you could write that code and you could sell it perfectly happily. You would have to make sure that the people that you sold it to had the keys themselves. So in other words, what you can't do with it is you can't write a software product, give it to people, and then say, oh, but we're not giving you the keys, so you can't modify it. So, you know, I mean, the people I find who moan about this either don't understand what it is that's being prevented, or as usual, there's a lot of people out there who basically just want to use other people's code for free. You know, they want to use it without any responsibilities. Somebody actually made a great argument on Slashdot today, actually, where they were saying, somebody said, oh, well, the BSD license is so much freer, or whatever, and somebody said, oh, so, you know, what's your opinion on the right to, on the freedom to own slaves? Essentially, the comment is that the GPL is restricting freedom. Well, it's restricting your ability to stop other people from being free. And I think the DRM clause is completely consistent with that.
Uh-huh.
So, like I say, the things that it restricts are things that are inconsistent with software freedom. And the GPL has always been about software freedom. The DRM clause really is no more controversial than the clause that says you can't sign away individual patent licenses. That's a restriction as well, yet people accept that.
Right. So GPL version 3 comes out. It contains the changes in it to invalidate the Novell-Microsoft agreement. What happens?
Well, I don't think it will invalidate the Novell-Microsoft agreement. What I think it means is that when Microsoft distributes SUSE Linux, which they are doing, at that point, the GPL v3 will say, and if you redistribute code under this, you are granting a patent license for any patents that are covered. So I think what will happen is after the GPL v3 comes out and lots of projects move to it, at that point, I'm guessing Microsoft will go to Novell and say, we need to change this. Because Novell won't care.
Right.
You know, I mean, because it's not hurting Novell. I mean, this is the actual decency of it, is that it's not designed to hurt Novell. Because I think, you know, Novell has none of the power in this. Like I said in one comment, I said Novell really is a victim, but they were a willing victim, and that's what I was unhappy about. The goal is designed to make Microsoft think, no, this is a really bad idea, we shouldn't do it.
So if they were to then distribute software under the GPL version 3 license, that would essentially make it impossible for them to sue anybody for patent violations, wouldn't it? Because
yep,
then they'd be
absolutely.
Essentially violating
that's,
their own...
That's the goal. Well, no, that's the goal is you know, if you redistribute software under GPL v3, the patents that might be covered in there, you are given an implicit patent grant.
Right.
And that's actually the same. That's almost the same as what's in the GPL version 2. It's very, very similar. People seem to think that GPL version 3 is a very radical document. It's actually an extremely moderate one. In terms of the positions it takes and the changes that it makes to the GPL version 2. I mean, you know, there were some incredibly crazy ideas, you know, that were originally being kicked out that would have been kicked around that would have been truly radical and crazy. And I think the GPL v3 is a fairly moderate document.
Yeah.
I remember I was in London at one of the Linux shows there, and it was really funny because they had a lawyer on one of the panels I was on, and this lawyer was saying, "Oh, the GPL v3 is terrible. It's so radical. It's awful. It's a complete contrast to the GPL v2, which is moderate and reasonable and all this kind of stuff." And I just laughed because I remember 10 years ago talking to lawyers about the GPL v2. And they were like, "My God, this is communism! This is crazy!" 10 years later, and they're like, "Oh, well, of course, the moderate, reasonable, oh, the GPL v2, everybody likes and understands the GPL v2. And so I actually said, "You know, what makes you think in 10 years you're not going to be saying the same thing about the GPL v3?
Yeah, that's the truth. Yeah.
I mean, corporate lawyers used to go crazy over GPL v2. They're like, "This is insanity! If we even use this code, all of our stuff will be for free, and we'll be standing penniless with our Ferraris on the being driven away by homeless people."
So, are you seeing a lot of that mentality changing then?
Yeah, and you know, so they went from that to the well, other people are using this, and you know, some people have gone through the enlightened stage of, hey, you know, we can share a lot of our development costs doing this. Unfortunately, there's still a lot of people stuck on the hey, free code, we can use this and we don't have to pay anything part. You know, you have to go, I think you have to go through that stage before you get to the, hang on a minute, this is scientific, this is science as applied to developing software. Which is what it is.
Excellent. We had another question from a listener.
Alright, well, can I go in about 5 or 10 minutes, because I'm getting really hungry.
Oh, yeah, just one more question.
Okay.
Just one last question that a listener wanted to know about.
Okay.
Did you choose to work at Google? Did they come looking for you, or did you go, you know, apply at Google? And why did you choose to work for Google?
Well, I'd actually talked to Google before I went to Novell. So I'd already interviewed at Google before. And chose not to go there. And so I'm actually working with someone, Chris DeBona, who is the Google's open source guy, who had a very similar role and I know very well at VA Linux. And I spent a lot of time going around talking to the people here, about what they wanted to do and how Samba would fit into that and how I would fit into that. You know, because one of the reasons I originally chose Novell was I couldn't see how Samba would fit into Google. And you know, I like to feel useful. I like to feel that, you know, people are using the stuff it is that I'm doing. But I actually see pretty clearly now how I can contribute and how I can help things. And so it's kind of exciting. Essentially, after the I realized that the agreement wasn't going to get changed, you know, I basically chatted to Chris and said, you know, I turned you guys down a couple of years ago. You still interested? So, yeah, that's basically how it happened.
Well, that's great, and I'm glad that you landed at a place that you enjoy working for.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've just started, and like I say, it's drinking from the fire hose, but hopefully that will put to bed anyone's sort of, you know, comments that I'm terrible because I went somewhere for the money, because if I was going to do that, I would have gone there 2 years ago.
Right.
So, and that would have made a difference, but, yeah. I think it's going to be fun. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, there's just a lot of work to do. I'm kind of working quite hard at the moment. So, plus I'm learning, and it's always good to be in a place where you're learning new stuff.
Uh huh. That's true.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I wish you the best of luck at Google.
Oh, thanks a lot.
And I really appreciate you coming on. And I know you want to go eat, so. You go.
Cool.
Are you going down to the Google cafeteria?
I actually like to go home and have dinner with my family.
Great.
I know. You know, free food's nice and all, but you know, it's nice to sit at home sometimes. So.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much. We thank you for coming on.
Oh, no problem. I hope your listeners enjoyed it, and I hope I didn't come across as too much of a pompous blowhard.
Not at all. They'll love it.
Ted Hager used to say.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
All right. Cheers, you guys. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
All right, good night.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Da, 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 da. Well, that was Jeremy Allison.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now we're, I found that scale promo, which is great. I thought I had lost that, so I'll play that. Do we have a song for the end there,
Pat? I didn't pick anything.
All right, well, I'll go find something. Pat, do you have something? Do you guys have something you want to say? Something you want to talk about? Next topic?
Well, Link hasn't been on in a while. Link, you got anything?
No, I've been busy, man.
That's we've been busy doing, because I gotta excuse
to talk
myself
louder.
A minute. I'll be right back.
Talk louder, Lynn.
Talk louder. All right, I'll
there you go.
I'll talk weird into the into the phone because you guys are just like blowing me away. I got to hold it 4 or 5 inches away from my head. No,
we have to work on that issue still.
Yeah, I had some weird client at work that's just been like piling the work on, and that's why you guys haven't heard a whole lot from me lately. I haven't had a time to, you know, basically I've had enough time to come home and shower and go back to work for the last like week, and hopefully that kind of, you know, busyness will stop this weekend. So perhaps I can be back, you know, joining the rest of the Tech Show crew in-house next week even.
Cool. About time.
Seriously.
Cool. But I don't know. So there really is, you know, like there hasn't been a whole lot for me that's been going on other than, you know, I've been playing with my my new ferret and stuff like that when I have a second.
Now, you upgraded TrickBox, right, Link?
I did upgrade TrickBox. I did it but right before you guys went on the air last week. I had a few minutes, and I figured, you know, I'm really not going to be on the show anyway, and I got to leave in a few minutes, so I pushed a quick upgrade, figuring that, you know, of course it would break, and I would have to fix it after I got home at 4 o'clock in the morning. And, well, you know, I really did figure it that way. So I ran the updater script for it, and it updated everything, including the operating system. You know, like it upgraded Asterisk, then it upgraded TrickBox, and then upgraded CentOS all by itself. I did a reboot on it, and when it came back up, it was working perfectly. You know, and in fact, it was working better than it was before. The web interface stuff for it looks it's different. It looks really nice. It works very well. Can't say enough
good
things about it.
Because the old Asterisk at home, you couldn't do updates, right? The original version?
When I originally did this whole thing, I was using Asterisk at home, the distribution, and I really liked that, right? And you could, you know, you did the updates on that, and then everything was working really well, and then switched over to TrickBox, and I installed a very early TrickBox version, just slightly after 1.0, I think. And it might even be, the first one might even been right before 1.0. But I put that on, and I was kind of real disappointed with that, and it was quirky and buggy, I think. And I updated it just a couple of times, and it finally started working enough where, you know, I could live with it, so I just kind of left it alone, figuring I'm not going to touch it. Since it's working, I'll just leave it the way it is. And then I saw the announcement right before the show started last week. I got an RSS feed announcement saying that they upgraded everything and released TrickBox 2.0. So I figured, you know, what the hell, I would just go and do it and watch it break, you know. But to my astonishment, it didn't. And it worked really, really well, and I'm digging it, you know.
Now, I dropped back in right at the tail end of this, and my question was, how seamless was the upgrade?
I ran the TrickBox shell script that does the upgrade, and it upgraded Asterisk and the TrickBox software, and it also upgraded this CentOS stuff to the newest version of whatever it, you know, everything that it wanted to. And then I did a reboot, and I went into after the reboot, everything was up and working. No problems whatsoever. The only other thing that I had to do was when you first log into the new web-based system that they have, the config system, it asks you to upgrade some modules. And like you just like when you get into the free PBX part of the system, you go into free PBX and it says you need to upgrade these modules. There are upgrades. And I clicked on upgrade all, and it upgraded them all, and that was that. I mean, that was as hard as it was. I was really, really pleased with it and really surprised because I expected something horrible and way different. You know?
Now, did you just simply pull down the ISO, burn it to a disk, and run the script off the disk?
No, I was on my working copy. like my working TwixBox server, I just shelled in and ran the update command and it did it all, you know?
Oh, yeah. What version
were you
running?
I didn't burn any ISOs. It just did it.
What version were you running?
I think it was 102 or something like that.
Huh.
It was really, really quite old.
Dan, don't update the Asterisk server tonight.
Yeah, you might want to wait.
Not now.
Oh, TwixBox update SH. What happens if I run that right now?
Yeah. It'll update it.
Let's do it. A live update. Let's see if you guys will stay on.
Update, it would be the first time.
Update.
I'm going to run that, then, if you say it
works
pretty well.
But it's not just TwixBox update SH. It's TwixBox update, TwixBox-update.sh space update.
Okay, I found the script, so.
Yeah, and the first thing it'll do is it'll check for an update on the actual update script, and you should probably do that. And then after that, when you run it, it'll just update all the software. But, you know, like I said, it really was very painless, and it took a working TwixBox installation, and it made it a TwixBox installation that works very, very well.
Cool.
So it was a nice upgrade.
Awesome. That's great. And I'm going to do that, and I'll report back next week.
You should, because like I had no problems at all.
Or maybe not.
Yeah. It'll take down my whole system.
It may just be the Dan show next week.
Nah.
I did. It was a beautiful thing, I'm telling you.
I'll be crying. I got to save all my I saved my configurations and everything.
Now, see, when I did that, I figured I would just screw myself into having to do a clean reinstall, and I was okay with that, so I didn't even save anything. I just hit the update and said, you know, I want to see how bad it breaks, and then I'll just do a clean install. But it didn't break anything. Everything was working better than it was before. It only took just a very few minutes, and... you know, it's been working ever since, working really well.
Awesome.
Ever since.
Awesome. Well, I got a lot of feedback last week on my report of GNOME with, I believe I had mentioned, editing the desktop or default.desktop file to change my preferences, and a whole lot of people wrote back to me.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. Said,
yes, they did. A lot of people did.
No. You don't have to do it like that. There's an easier way to do it. And it's true. There is an easier way to do it. Now, if you're in GNOME, and I'm using GNOME on top of Ubuntu, and you pull up like Nautilus or something or whatever, and if you double-click on an icon, like say you have a video file or an AUG file, and you double-click on that, it's going to bring up the default application. But if you right-click on it, you get an open with menu, and you get a list of applications that have been configured that should work with said file type. For instance, I have an episode 01 of the Source podcast, or a video cast, and if I right-click on that and select Open With, it offers me the option to open it with Gzine, Kaboodle, MPlayer Movie Player, Noatun, or VLC Media Player, and then another option at the bottom to open with other application. Now, my experience with other operating systems and some other desktops is usually when you have a menu option like that, they would also provide maybe a checkbox in there to set this as a default application. And not seeing such a checkbox kind of threw me. And I thought, well, I guess there has to be some other way to set it, which, I kind of stepped away from looking on the right-click menu to do this into other ways. Because generally, if it wasn't there, I wouldn't expect it to still be somewhere in that right-click menu. But it actually is if you go down to the properties of the file, which, again, is not someplace I would expect to find a tab in there called Open With. All right, I expect usually properties tells me some basic information and the permissions of the file that can change those permissions. But there's actually a couple other tabs in here. One is Emblems, which allows me to change an emblem of the file. There's one for notes where I can put in my own notes. There's more information about the, you know, the type of file it is, being an audio video. There's some audio video app information in there, like the dimensions, the codec, the frame rate, stuff like that. But there's also a tab in there called Open With. Okay? Now, what differentiates Open With from the Open With right off, directly off the right-click menu, is that I have little radio boxes here where I can check one. And, of course, by default, the application to run in GNOME would be Totem. But I can then have a series of other applications in here, GZine, Kaboodle, Movie Player, M-Player, No Autune, or VLC. And if I choose one of those via the radio button, for instance, I choose M-Player, which is my preferred media player of choice. Once I click that there, then that sets the default application for all files of that said type. For instance, this is an AVI file. So now from now on, whenever I double-click on an AVI file, it is going to choose that application to run the AVI file. I don't actually have to go in and edit a custom desktop.defaults file like I talked about last week. So, you know, learn something new all the time. And again, like I said, it's not something I was used to having, you know, used to doing in the past. I would not have expected to find it there, but it is there. And now, also in conjunction with that, under the preferences menu, there is a option in there called removable drives and media. And this is another place to set some of these default application permissions. For instance, when I pull this up, I have a bunch of tabs. One is storage, you know, for removable storage. Another one in that, in there, it says, you know, what happens if I input a blank CD or a DVD disc, blank DVD. And it says, what should it do for a command for opening audio CDs? And by right now, by default, the application is Serpentine, but I could change that. What about data CDs? Well, it says open up Nautilus so I can use that for CD burning. What caught my attention, though, was the multimedia tab, which says if I put in an audio CD, what application should it run? And by default in there, I have Sound Juicer, so I could change that if I wanted to. Now, it provides drop-down menus, but a lot of these drop-down menus aren't populated. So it looks like you're going to have to browse for the application or put it in yourself. Now, in my case, there's an option here for video DVD discs. Now, I prefer Zine for playback of DVD discs. And by default, of course, it had Totem in there. So when I go to drop down the option for to change Totem to something else, it didn't give me an option, so I had to manually put Zine in there. Now, the command line for running Totem and opening the disk automatically off of this through Nautilus was Totem space percent M is what it was. Now, for Zine, it was a little different. Now, of course, on Ubuntu, you don't get Zine. By default, you get Gzine. So I had to use Gzine and then space DVD colon forward slash. Now, I couldn't use percent M. I had to use the colon forward slash after DVD to get it to automatically open up Gzine and start playing the DVD when I put it into the system. So, you know, you should actually look at some of those tabs there if you're looking for some other ways to change stuff like storage, multimedia, PDAs, printers and scanners, and input devices like mice and other things. You can change some defaults there and tablets. So that's what I learned this week, particularly with GNOME. Thanks,
so
everybody.
What do you think overall? I mean, with GNOME, you've been really...
I'm getting more accustomed. Yeah, I'm getting more accustomed to it. One of the other complaints I had was with the GNOME run dialogue. What I'm used to entering in the application, like starting to type and then hitting tab to fill it in, the rest of it in, which it doesn't really work like that. Instead, what somebody had said to me is instead of doing that, use the up and down arrow keys. And that works a little better. Works a little better. It's still not what I would really like it to do, but we're getting there. We're getting there. Sometimes it works the way I want it to. Sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, I... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Pat.
Go ahead, finish.
What really has caught my interest. I mean, right now I'm reading a book called Why Software Sucks, and it's a really interesting book. If you have an opportunity to pick it up, maybe at a library or actually go out and buy it, it's an in-depth look by the guy's primarily a Windows programmer, and he goes through it, and it's really a very informative book, but it's hilarious at the same time, and it's really cool. And he goes through and he talks about a lot of usability issues and, you know, why software today sucks and how it could be made better and what people can do to make it better, even if you're not a developer. He's like got a lot of great suggestions in there. And I'm looking at GNOME, and I'm sitting here wondering to myself, am I having a problem with GNOME because I am so accustomed to other operating systems and desktop managers that I am approaching it from the expectation of those, and maybe having learned or forced myself to learn the way that those operate and having to work in that type of environment and getting used to it has kind of pulled me away from GNOME, who has done, I believe through Novell, has done a lot of usability tests in GNOME. And maybe, you know, for the general population, for the majority of users new to a system that, you know, not having approached it, that this is more usable to them. I mean, it's hard for me to answer that because I'm polluted with having a past in other operating systems and desktops.
Dan, we know you're polluted, Dan.
So I'm
nothing new.
I'm really curious.
We've smelled that pollution before.
You know, it's tough to approach it from a different perspective when you've been ingrained so long how to do things. Like, you know, I made a comment that KDE has been held up as the most popular and widely used desktop environment now, and most comfortable for new users who are just getting into Linux to use. And part of the reason I suspect that is it's very similar to the Windows Windows environment. You know, you got the start menu at the bottom. You got a menu that, you know, system that pops up. I'm not saying that KDE is exactly like Windows. There are significant improvements, I think, to the user interface. But
sure, it works.
Right. Aside from that, but there's a lot of familiarity there. Now, is that the most usable interface, or is that the interface that a lot of people are accustomed to? I mean, I don't know if I'm qualified to answer those questions because I'm not a usability expert, and I've been so accustomed to other ways. You know, approaching GNOME from the viewpoint of Fluxbox is asinine because they're totally different systems and totally different ways to configure those systems. Sure, I can go down there and start mucking around with the configuration files, the XML files on the command line, but, you know, because I'm not used to seeing the actual configuration in a different light, which might be, you know, easier for the majority of people to use. But, you know, that's kind of my take. I'm really starting to get accustomed to GNOME and starting to like it and enjoy it. I'm not hindered by it anymore, and I actually enjoy exploring it further. When somebody sends me an email or posts on my blog or sends something to the show about it, I'm always eager to finally get back in there and, you know, try this stuff out and see if it does work and get used to it. You know, and speaking on the lines of the usability there with that,
I think you're thinking about it too much, Dan. Just use it.
Just use it, huh? I had issued a complaint like the past 2 weeks that I couldn't get audio capture to work on this System 76 laptop.
So you're posting there.
Yeah, I had a lot of problems with it. It would just not work at all. And I finally posted to their forum about it. And I've read some other posts similar to it, and they say, well, you know, look at the volume settings, this and that. Now, I'm so used to when somebody says adjust my volume settings, I go right down there to the Alsa mixer, start playing around with the audio settings and doing other things. And for some reason, that was not working for me. Now, sure enough, like a few hours after I post to the forums, I go to click on my internet connection. And because sometimes when I boot up, it's for some reason grabs the wireless connection downstairs first as opposed to my one up here. And I went to double check this, and I bumped the audio the little volume control by accident and brought that up. And when I brought that up, I noticed that there was a whole lot of other, you know, graphical ways to configure different things in here. And I saw, you know, there's something there for my microphone. And then in the capture, there were separate channels for the microphone and for the onboard capture without having to use a the microphone on board. So I was like, wow, I wonder if I fiddle with these, if that's going to make a difference. So sure enough, I bring up Audacity, I press record, and I'm getting audio in without having a microphone plugged in. So I'm like, wow, this is great. So I run over here, I plug the audio jack in off of the mixer into the system, and I try recording. I'm not getting anything. So, okay, so I pull it out again, and I try it, and I'm like, okay, it works with the internal microphone. It'll pick it up. But for some reason, I can't get it through the external microphone. So then I decide, now that I know that the recording is actually working, I come over here to my Sound Blaster Extreme Box, and I pull the line in we have coming from the mixer out of the Sound Blaster Extreme. I plug it into the box, into the microphone jack on the laptop, and I start recording through the microphone I have here, and it's working. So the next thing I says to me, okay, the problem then has to be the cable I'm using, right? There has to be a problem with the cable. So I try a different cable the same way. I just have an eighth inch jack to an eighth inch jack that has an adapter on it to what's that larger jack called? Is that a quarter inch jack?
Quarter inch.
Right. And for some reason, it doesn't like the quarter inch converter to an eighth inch into the here. I can't use it. So I went out to Radio Shack today, and I got myself one of those eighth inch to a RCA. And then we have over here, I found an RCA to a quarter inch jack converter. And I plugged all that in, and it works perfectly. So it was a combination of the different mixer applications on here, it appears, and also getting a cable that worked properly. So things seem to be working now. The recording works. So, you know, it was my mistake, not System 76's, and thumbs up.
Cool.
Makes me happy.
People on the RC are wondering when the TLLTS magazine is going to be coming out. And when are we going to have TLLTS TV?
But it's not really TLLTS magazine. It's the Linux Link magazine, which Dan has been working on, trying to get the first issue out for, what, 8 years now?
Yeah.
At a minimum, 8 years.
You know, it's funny because in that time period of 8 years, if you actually, what is it, the Internet Archive, is that it, where you can go look back at the websites, websites, homepage, different pages throughout the years? I think, is that called the Internet Archive?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, if you go back and you look at the LinuxLink.net website, you notice the evolution from LinuxLink coming soon, a magazine dedicated to learning Linux, to all sorts of. For 3 years, it was like that until we changed it over to other stuff. Yeah, I think the closest we got to doing the magazine was messing around with Scribus templates, but was that a year and a half ago?
Well, I don't know. We had a couple of preliminary discussions about actually starting it up, and it never got any farther than that, so.
Yeah.
Well, it turned into the show.
Well, magazine articles are tough because you actually have to spend some time researching, you know, writing it, you know.
Yeah, you got the whole writing it and having somebody proof it and then
proofread it, yep.
And then, then laying it out. It's a lot. It is a significant amount of work.
It's a lot of work.
And, you know, not that I'm not interested in doing something like that, but I don't want to end up, you know, having all four of us try and write an article every issue or fill it up. You know, if there was a couple other people interested, maybe we could put something.
Shoot,
like that.
I don't even do a blog post every quarter.
Seriously, yeah. What was the last time Alan posted on his blog? About 6 months ago?
Yeah.
September, I think, yeah. November, maybe.
I mean, I guess you got to ask yourself why. Why not, just go contribute or read Tux magazine, but no, you can't because they're gone. Linux,
Linux
Gazette.
Journal.
Linux Gazette.
Yeah, any
Linux
of those
Journal
magazines.
Has online articles.
Linux Format.
Now. Yeah. I mean, maybe in the future, you know, that or a video podcast. I don't know. They're both like really involved endeavors.
Well, with the magazine articles, at least you get paid.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doesn't hurt, you know?
It doesn't. Not at all. Not at all. But, I don't know if there's people interested in download or writing articles. Maybe we could put something together.
It's all work, you know? Someone has to step up and, you know, want to do it.
Right.
I just put the link on there for the first one.
Oh, God.
Coming soon, a comprehensive newsletter to help you unleash the potential of Linux.
Yeah, that's right. I remember seeing that for a long
that
time.
That was forever.
I think according to the Wayback Internet Archive Wayback on there, it looks like you're going to, let me try 2002, it's still there.
Oh yeah, man, it was there for a long
June 7th, 2003, we've actually changed it at that point. So when did it change?
Wow, that's amazing, man. Those old pages come up.
Yep. Gotta love it.
That's a different one.
You'll never escape. It'll be there forever. Your shame will hang
on
over your
fact,
head.
Number 5, it says, when will the first issue be released? We're shooting for an August release, ideally. We'd like to complete 2 issues worth of material before releasing the first.
Yeah, notice I never said August of what year.
Yeah, what year, yeah.
At least, Dan, at least you didn't say, okay, the new episodes, you know, the new episode's coming out next week, and we never release it.
Yeah.
You know? It's one thing to say it's coming out on a certain date and you miss it. At least we never, you know, promised anything, you know?
Right. Like what? Who are you referring to?
I'm not referring to anybody. What are you referring to?
I don't know. I thought you were,
to anybody.
So did we find music or no?
Do we? I'm working on pulling some music down.
Well, my band cave is being built as we speak.
Yeah, I read your post on that.
I can't wait to have it done, man. There's nothing like having your own band cave.
We're in mine. It's only on the second floor,
yeah,
though.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably going to be looking for, I don't know, thinking of things, you know, like where to put my gear. I don't know. I know Link has that nice hunch that he picked up when he reorganized his apartment. And I don't know if I should do that or maybe do like, you know, like a baker's rack and put everything up on racks. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I have no clue.
I mean, I don't have a ton of servers. I got like maybe four. I got 4 boxes.
Closet where they're quiet.
You think? Seal them up?
Well, as long as, I mean, airflow and all, but a closet. Out of the way, out of sight. Out of mind till they catch fire.
And then you can't use the closet for anything.
Build another closet.
See, now, the more I think about it with my gear, I'm thinking, you know, put them in like a relay rack or something like that, because it's always nice to be able to get around the back of your servers and stuff if you need to get in and fix something. I really wish that I had the room to do that, you know?
I'm a little hesitant to put it into a closet, but building a storage room, so all those, you know, we have these big-ass trunks full of just crap, you know. It's got a perfect place to put them, you know, so.
Yeah, you're getting a contractor to do that, right?
Yeah. I'm no carpenter, man. But I'm going to have to be doing the wiring, too.
I hit a hammer.
Definitely going to be setting up some speaker cable, some Cat 5, and some coaxial. So, probably set up some connections. You guys know of any good places where I can get, like, you know, those little ports to hook up, you know, like a Cat 5 connection or little coaxial connection? Know any websites online? They carry all that stuff?
Home Depot, that stuff, man. Just go to Home Depot. You're good.
Yeah, or you hit one of the electrical supply stores.
Yeah.
Queen City, baby. Well, that's kind of weird to go there because it's like in the nasty part of Allentown, and it doesn't look like
an entrance.
I never got shot going there, but I go there for work, pick stuff up. But they were pretty good. They were pretty good.
So what do you guys? I sent an email out last week to you guys about a new format where we won't do interviews every week. What we'll do is we'll do 2 weeks with an interview, then 1 week without. What do you guys think about that?
That works.
I thought we were going to do that a long time ago. I thought we talked about doing that a long time ago, and it sort of like just fell away.
Not exactly.
Okay.
Because I was looking over some of the results from the survey. You know, Dan gave us the links to that. I was going in and reading through some of that. You know, the survey is doing great. If you haven't already gone on and done the survey, please do so. It's open for, what, another week, right, Dan?
Yeah.
Vote now, vote often.
It closes, I believe, January 17th.
So we got a week. So if you haven't done it already, please go in and fill it out. The feedback has been fantastic. A lot of people have already done it. Just look over some of the results. I don't want to go into the results. You know, we'll have our great unveiling probably, I don't know, next week or the week after.
Yeah.
We'll
I don't know.
We'll talk about it in detail.
When's January 17th? That's
next week.
Yeah. I don't know if we're going to be able to compile the results. Unless it closes on, I got to check out how it operates. Is it still open the 17th and closes the 18th?
Or does it close at midnight?
Yeah, I wonder. I'll have to double check that. And, well, maybe I'll just close it at midnight. And if I can pull the results out after that and get it in a format, that's the one thing I haven't really investigated as to whether the results, I could just quickly dump them out and, you know, post them and we can discuss them.
Because one of the reasons, I mean, I'll just touch on it briefly. One of the things that people say they really like about the show is without just talking about tech stuff, you know, not necessarily the guests. I mean, people like the interviews and stuff, but they really like the fact that we talk, you know, in depth about technology and Linux and what we're doing. So if we have like a structure where, you know, we do two episodes with a guest, the third week we don't have a guest. It's just us just shooting the breeze and going and doing whatever. What do you think? You think it's something you want to do regularly?
We could try it out.
I have no problem with it.
As long as we have content.
Exactly. Instead of just, you know, staring at each other going, what?
That'll be the week Link doesn't show up again.
Well, nobody wants to listen to me anyway, right?
No, I didn't say that. I always want to listen to you, baby.
Yeah.
I always do.
I try to do content, you know. Sometimes it's difficult, though.
Well, you know, what are you going to do?
Again.
What are you going to do? So hopefully, yeah, dead air. That's
that's a killer.
I don't know. I'm looking at pictures of Carnival.
Yeah, I was looking at, like, the scantily clad chicks from Brazil.
What the heck are you guys
like
doing
over
there?
Looks like a fun place to go. This is on, like, Yahoo.
I know people have gone to that. It's insane from what I hear.
Looks fun. Well, that doesn't, but...
It won't go any farther. Hey, has anyone got the audio of the Mac World Keynote from yesterday?
No, but you can download
on it. I'm looking on the internet. I can't find it anywhere.
Go to Apple's webpage. It'll take you right to it.
All they got is QuickTime video, as far as I know.
Yeah, I'll download it and strip the audio out.
You should be able to play it fine once you get your iPhone, Pat.
Yeah, I'm right on that. $499 up there.
Woo. That's awesome.
And $299 for an iTV where you can't record anything. The only thing you can do is stream video clips that you bought from iTunes.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, but you know, you could actually, if you have a Mac and stuff on it, and you have a MythBox, there's a script out there called Myth to iPod, I think is what it's called. And what it does is it automatically converts all the stuff that you're recording.
But you still need a MythBox.
Yeah, but you give a MythBox so you have a back end somewhere.
But
so
if
you
already have a MythBox, why do you need the iPod?
Because you may have another room where you don't want to put a front end in. And that would make a nice little front end.
The TV, baby.
Because actually, I was thinking of playing around with that, even though I don't have a video iPod or anything like that. I'm thinking of putting that script onto my MythBox just to play around and see how it actually comes up. I just, like I said, I don't have a video iPod, so it's not going to do any good for me to download on it. But it does provide a link in, it does provide a feed into iTunes so that you see all of what you recorded over in iTunes. So if you did have a video iPod, you could actually just pull it off right onto that.
I so do not care about that, personally.
Yeah, to me it's interesting.
$300, you think it's worth it?
Well, I don't know. For me, not right now, no. But like I said, that's one way of using it, that you don't have to worry about buying shit from iTunes. It's just another
place. I don't just buy anything from iTunes.
Neither do I. That's why I have the Mac here, and all the shit doesn't really bother me, because all I have is either podcasts on it or my own music. So I don't buy anything from iTunes, so I don't really care about all the restrictions and crap that go along with it. But it would be a neat thing if I wanted to put a nice little box in the living room downstairs, and I didn't want to put a normal white box, I didn't want to build my own stuff on it, that would be one way of doing it. I already have the wireless there. I have the Mac upstairs here. It would be one way.
Well, what's interesting is they didn't even talk about the Macs. You notice that?
Most of the time, I don't think anything came out.
Yeah, they changed their company name. It's just Apple now, not Apple Computer.
You know what? You know what's killing me, though? Like, and I know that we have a large, real diehard Linux fan base here, but even you guys, if you go and you look at the product announcements for these things, they're really not that impressive, especially for the money that they're asking. And the thing that I'm contrasting this with is, like, the one thing that really bothers me is the iPhone, right? It's a phone that they're binding to a certain carrier, and it costs, what, $600 or something like that?
$499.
$500. Good grief, man. $500, you get a year of service on this thing, right? That's a lot of bread.
That's not even including the month-to-month charges from Singular.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but if you already have a Singular account, it's not a big deal, because
$500 is a big deal.
$500 is a big deal, but people are going to spend that on that. If you're going to spend that kind of money on a phone, you're going to spend that money anyways.
I can't see myself spending that money on a phone.
No, I can't either. But I've spent $200 on phones without blinking an eye about it.
What do you actually get for the $500 phone?
An iPod integrated.
Yeah, you get something that plays music. You get a cell phone. And does it do video? I forget. It might do like iTunes video kind of thing.
It does video.
Now for $100 less than that, for $100 less than that, for $400, you can get the new Nokia N800, which is the next gen Nokia 770 that a lot of us have. Now that looks really freaking cool. The only problem is it's not a phone. You know what I mean? You can use, some internet telephony with it, some voice over IP stuff. But it's just it's twice the computer that the Nokia 770 is. It's a little pocket computer.
Oh, yeah, but that's selling to a different market, though. The people who will buy the iPhone won't think twice about spending $500 on it. They won't think twice about it.
They're like Apple fanboys.
Well, it's fanboys. It's people who just this is really neat. I want to buy the damn thing.
Yeah,
those people aren't going to think twice about it. They're going to walk in there. They're going to slap down their credit card and walk out with a phone, and they don't really care.
Same people are that are going to order the ITV that Apple's selling right now too, $300 basically.
Same thing there.
The $300 video card.
What you want to wait is if you want an iPhone, wait a year. Because there'll be people selling those things, and they're SIM chipped. So all you got to do is pull out a SIM. If you already have a Singular account, you just pull out your SIM card and pop it into that phone, and you're good to go.
Can't wait for people to get ripped off.
You know who's going to have an iPhone?
The iPhone.
Alan's going to have an iPhone. I bet.
Alan's going to have an iPhone. I bet. I'm make a prediction to Alan. You will have an iPhone within 6 months.
They're going to come out with the iPhone condom.
You're wrong. He has it now.
He has it now.
He called up Steve and said, yo, send it this way.
Yo,
my
dog.
Brand new razor's getting rusty.
Exactly. And I need a phone already.
That's right.
There's a scratch on this one. I need a new phone.
Well, you'll have to make sure that when you get one, we all know you're going to. So when you get it, you're going to have to do a product review on it for us so that we know what how the touch screen works and all that stuff. Of course, I'm going to have to come over and play with it, too.
You know, even if I would get one, I would still not get one of the first ones, no. I've been burned by first-time things in general, period, on it. You know, even the Razor, which I picked up, I did wait, you know, 6-8 months for that one to come out. Well, that's not that long. I did wait a while for that one just because there's always a rev that comes out that's a little bit better and it fixes some of the bugs.
Then you can hear about people in the subway station get their iPhones ripped off.
Yeah, well, it's gonna, you know,
people get beat up for their iPhones.
That happens all the time, anyways. Wear white earbuds. Yeah, exactly. But you know, wear white earbuds in the city, and you're liable to get hit for whatever the hell you're carrying.
What are you gonna do? What? You know, speaking of Myth TV, the Linux Action Show did a great review of Myth TV. I don't know if you guys listened to it.
Yeah, I did.
Yes.
Action show.
Yeah, it was good stuff. And, you know, I really want to set one of these things up as soon as I save some money for some hardware to do that.
It is nice. They are really nice.
Yes, I do.
Even though, like I said, you know, I only record cartoons on the damn thing, but, you know, it's still good to have.
Anime.
I don't feel like staying up. Well, I do that, too, yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't want to stay up at 2 o'clock in the morning to watch adults swim, you know?
I hear you. And speaking of podcasts, there is a new Linux podcast that started up at the end of December, I believe, called Linux on the Desktop, Linux Desktop for Beginners podcast. You guys, I don't know if you saw the email Marlon Dunn sent to us about it, and I checked it out. I like it. It's pretty good. It's a nice little intro, you know, podcast for new users coming to Linux, specifically from, you know, focusing on the graphical environment and working within the graphical environment and not so much on the command line. But it's pretty good. And what's interesting is the podcast, works in conjunction with the book he published, and he self-published the book through Lulu. And I have a copy of that coming, so I'll review that in the future. But the website is www.linuxonthedesktop.org. He provides a MP3 and AUG files. Right now the feed he has both the files in there. He said he's working on getting just a specific AUG feed, though, too. Pretty interesting stuff. And also, Marlon lives, I guess, right around Philadelphia area. Said he's going to be showing up sometime in the summer at one of the LUG meetings, LV LUG meetings.
Cool. That'd be cool.
You know, look out for it. Yeah. It's pretty good.
We should get him on the show.
Yeah, I sent him an email about, you know, hopefully we can get him on the show in the near future. Kick, I know we won't have to listen to Dave Yates anymore. you know what?
Podcasting at 75 miles per hour.
Yeah. Before we do sign off, though, Link, can you readdress the Flourish conference stuff? Because you kind of got cut off when Jeremy came back on.
I will. Let me pull this up. You guys want to go to www.flourishconf.com. The link is, or will be very soon. In the, there we go, in the IRC forum, an IRC chat. Flourish is a free and open source software conference in Chicago, April 6th and 7th, 2007. Going to have, at the very least right now, is going to have Chris DeBona there speaking. And the kind of things that they want to talk about there is how's FLOSS used in the academic and research communities? Does FLOSS generate new academic opportunities? Will FLOSS tools and expertise increase your marketability after you graduate? This is held at the college over there. Has the time finally come for companies to set up shop around Floss, et cetera, et cetera, and so on and so forth? And they are, you know, they're looking for participation. Yeah, it's been a really, really long day for me. They're looking for participation and, you know, people to come and help out and listen to what's going on, and maybe some talkers too, I guess, helpers. So please hit that website and contact them there. And I was wondering if anybody, you know, if anybody listening now, like on the forum, is anywhere around Chicago, get us some more local information.
There you go.
Dan, you're gonna play the scale promo, right?
I will be doing that. Yes, that's
scale. Sounds like a great
Roberto
Solano
is the one that emailed this to us.
What, the Flourish?
The Flourish, okay. From. Let me see if I can get this. Here we go. From Luggett UIC, which is a University of Chicago, I think, University of Indiana, Chicago, something like that. Anyway, he's the vice president of the Lug there, and gave me some information. Perhaps we can get him on the show soon to give us a talk about what's going on with that and get some more information.
Cool. Lots of cool shows coming up.
Yeah. We don't have a lot of guests coming up.
I have 2 or 3 in the pipeline. I'm just going to nail down some dates.
All right, cool. And next week we're not having a guest, right? This is going to be
us. It's going to be just us next week.
All right. Call for help here. If maybe somebody can help, one of our listeners can help out. One of our other listeners had posted a forum, and I guess all over the place, Vogatir is his name. I think that's how it's pronounced. Anyway, he had a problem with GNOME and F-Spot, where when he plugged in his camera, it came up and asked whether he wanted to use it as a mass storage device or a PTP, I think it is, or PPT, through GPhoto 2, and he accidentally hit the PPT one, and now he can't get it, find out where he can change that setting. I've been looking around. I guess a lot of people, where that setting is up in the air. Nobody seems to know how he can get rid of it. Now, if he goes in as a different user, that's not a problem, but he'd really like to fix it on the user account he has. If anybody has an idea as to where to find that setting, give a shout out to us, or, you know, come into our forums and post. He's been looking to solve this for, like, since November, if I'm not mistaken. So I know there's a lot of pretty smart people out there that'll listen to us eventually. But that's, you know, if you can help, that'd be great. And anything on the Frapper map, Pat?
Just a couple. We got Nicholas Malfoy from Paris, France, and Kane from New Caney, Texas. That's it.
Oh, okay.
That's it. Oh, we need more people.
Yeah.
Yes.
Come on, you bums.
If you're listening, you must go to the Frapper map and tell us that you're listening. We need to know these things.
And awesome. If you haven't taken a survey, take the survey.
Cool. And
if you're just going to bitch about stuff on the survey, just, you know, go fucking listen to Lug Radio or something, right?
Jesus.
You know, if you can't be constructive and you're going to be a dick, just go away. That's what I think. And that goes for you too, Dan.
Yeah.
Just go away. He did.
Go fuck away.
He did. He went away to Virginia.
I had to get away. I had to run to a different state to get away from you.
No, you had to run to a different state so they could fumigate your old freaking office.
Yeah, they finally chased me out.
The neighborhood got up on it.
They all ganged up on him. They had to rip his house down to the ground, you know, and dig down 20 feet.
The new people moved into the house, and the bird died. They woke up one morning, and the poor bird was dead.
That's not nice.
That was the smell in New York the other day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, did I tell you I was in New York?
There you go.
Actually, with the warm weather, it just blew it up. You know, it blew it out to the sea, and it came back in.
Came up the coastline.
right into New York. Sorry. I apologize. But that's the way it goes. Are you guys going to that cafe place this weekend?
We are, yep.
Now, did you let them know you're coming, or you're just going to show up?
No, I was there today. I stopped off on the way home from work, and I talked to the guy. He seemed pretty cool. He's had 2,600 meetings in there and different groups in there.
What is it? I mean, what is this type of place?
It's an internet cafe. It's like maybe 10 workstations. There's a couple of tables. You can bring your own laptop. He has like a bar where he has like all different beverages, and you can get like bagels and pastries and stuff.
Not beer, though.
I don't think beer, no.
You know what?
Coffee shop.
Tell them Tell them to fix their website so it renders properly in Firefox.
Well, we'll have to make that correction
Firefox
when we get there.
Firefox under Linux, particularly. I don't know. I haven't tested under any other OS.
Well, the guy who's the owner, he's a network admin, and he does mostly Windows and Mavel. And he says he's just getting into Linux, and he definitely wants to, you know, listen into the whole meeting and stuff and participate. He seemed pretty interested in it.
I guess so, because he's going to close the place down before we get there, right?
Yeah, he's closing at 2 o'clock.
He's locking
the
door. That's what he's doing.
Yes. We don't want those people coming around. Now, do we have the site on the site we're going to meet on the website?
It's on the mailing list.
It's on the mailing list. Okay, I have to dig it up again.
It'll be on the website soon enough.
Now, is this guy friends with a certain other vocal computer club / user in the area that we've had dealings with in the past?
Didn't ask him.
I don't think so. I'd be highly surprised if he's not.
Member of the LVCG.
Maybe. I don't know. Was, then he wasn't. Now he is. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, Dad, it's getting late. Play us out.
All right, we'll play you out.
Yeah.
Al's kicking me out of the house.
No. It's just, you know, 4:30 comes
house,
early.
Right.
Yeah, tonight.
All right,
he's gonna throw Pat out the window any minute now.
All right, I'm gonna play us. Here's the Scale promo. Hopefully, I haven't listened to this yet, so hopefully, it won't blow our ears out.
Yeah.
All
right.
It.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks a lot for listening.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, Link, I gotta cut you off. That's right.
Okay, I'm out of here.
All right, take it easy.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. Helps if I press the play button, not the pause.
I was going to say, yeah, it's sort of silent there.
So we can paint anything we want.
Oh, wait.
Anything.
Not quite.
Did
that
your computer
play
crash?
Button.
Are you aggravated with computer viruses and spyware? Are you looking for an alternative to Microsoft Vista? Whether you're an expert or have only just heard of Linux, here's your chance to learn more at the Southern California Linux Expo. You'll meet users of all skill levels and organizations who will show you what open source software can do for you at home or at work. The Expo has speakers who will discuss various hot topics in open source software, and this year we've even added beginner sessions to especially help those of you who are just starting out. The Southern California Linux Expo is February 10th and 11th, 2007, at the Westin Hotel at Los Angeles International Airport. For more information or to register, please visit www.socallinuxexpo.com. Use promo code CAST, C-A-S-T, for 40% off your registration. We'll see you there.
It's over.
Shut up.
Just shut up.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush.
I am man, hear me roar. The number's too big to ignore. And I'm way too hungry to settle for chick food. 'Cause my stomach's starting to growl, and I'm going on the prowl for a Texas double whopper. Man, that's good. Oh yes, I'm a guy. I'll admit I've been fed quiche. Way tofu, bye bye. Now it's for whopper beef I reach. I will eat this meat till my age turns into an owie. I am starved. I am incorrigible, and I need to stuff a big burger, beef, bacon, jalapeno, good thing down.
Yeah!
I am hungry.
I am hungry.
I am incorrigible. I am man.
The Texas Double Whopper. Eat like a man.